Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I'm getting a chance to have my second conversation with Dr. Aubrey de Grey. And where we left our last conversation, we were talking about quantity versus quality where aging was concerned, and that this was something that many people said, and many people talked to you about it. Would you like to continue that conversation, then we'll go on to what our perspective is, please?
Sure, yes. So there's a huge amount of attention paid to the supposed trade-off or, you know, tension between quality and quality when it comes to extending healthy life. And this is, like, it's annoying. It really just irritates me, because the fact is, it's a complete straw man. And everybody knows it's a straw man. Everybody knows that the only way we're going to get any kind of extension of life, any substantial extension anyway, through the work that people like myself are doing, is by extending healthy life. In other words, longevity is a side effect of health. And so, you know, waving your hands and making a terrible amount of noise about the fact that it's not, you know, it doesn't sound very good to live a lot longer if the quality of life is poor, is completely irrelevant to what's actually being done.
So if, when we're talking about making healthier choices, how do we get human beings to make healthier choices? When I'm 71 this year, and when I was growing up, I was one of like 20 fat kids in my class. At that time, overweight was an anomaly. It has gotten to where, certainly with the kinds of processed foods and the kinds of that we have, that our weight has increased a lot, and that's making an impact, of course, on our health, which makes an impact on our aging, which makes an impact on it all. So where do we intersect this to make healthier choices, in your opinion?
Okay, so here is, of course, a question where quality and quantity absolutely are in opposition, and there is a trade-off to be made. Today, when we do not have the kinds of medicines that I'm working to develop, we absolutely have a trade-off, simply because a lot of the things that people enjoy doing are bad for you. And in particular, you've made a great example of the case of overeating, or eating a poor diet. The same, of course, applies to smoking. I don't have any clever new ideas for how to get people more interested in living a healthy life. I mean, the only real new thing I could say is, maybe if it's not good enough to just live a healthy life because you're going to enjoy it more being healthy, then maybe you should think ahead to the fact that that healthy life will be longer and will give you a better chance of surviving long enough to benefit from the therapies I'm working to develop, which, of course, at which point you will be able to get away with living a less healthy life than you can get away with today.
All right. So tell me a little bit about getting a biotechnology startup. Let's work from that angle of it so that I understand. How do you get a biotechnology startup? Who do you pitch? What do you tell people? Who are the people that are interested in investing in this?
So you mean, how does one actually create a biotechnology startup?
Tell us the story.
Well, first of all, I didn't do it. I've never done that. The organization that's been created around my work is a nonprofit. We are a 501c3 public charity based in Silicon Valley. But what we do is we spin out projects as startup companies. And I also work closely with a lot of other people who are in our space, who have created startup companies independently of us. So how does one do that? Well, of course, the first step is to have exciting new results, to have some new idea with some kind of data behind it, and ideally with some kind of protection by patent or whatever, that is in some way relevant to keeping people alive for a longer time in a better state of health. Of course, the work that one has at the point that one creates a company will typically not include any actual clinical data, any data on people. Normally, it will only include data in the laboratory on cells in culture or in mice. But that's okay. The question you asked is, how does one find investors? Well, that's a two-way street, you see, because investors are also looking for investment opportunities just as much as the founders of companies are looking for the investors. And a lot of what I do is to facilitate that two-way street. Because I'm a high-profile guy in this field, everyone can contact me easily. People do contact me all the time from both ends of that equation. And so I spend a lot of my time just making introductions. Of course, investors also are interested in being introduced to each other, because different investors have different levels of expertise, in whether it's on the science side or the business side. They have different sizes of check that they may want to write, all that kind of thing. So investors often get together as a consortium to support a given company. So it's a whole ecosystem.
I find it fascinating, because reversing aging or delaying aging, or this has been there's been a lot of bad information out there, or a lot of snake oil salesmen that have that. And so when you enter this, how do you separate yourself? And because as the editor-in-chief of Rejuvenation Research, is this the way that you're, how do you sort between the things that you would like to include and the things that you don't?
Sure. This is actually a very important question, not only in terms of my evaluation of other people's work, but also in terms of other people's impression of me. It's very important, of course, for me to be to distance myself from snake oil salesmen and charlatans, and to ensure that people actually understand that I have, that I know what I'm talking about, that I'm not in this just to make money or anything, and that, you know, that what I say people ought to spend money on, they actually ought to. And so the first thing is that I am not, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not focused on the clinic. I'm focused on the early stage research that has not yet got into clinical trials, let alone being on the market. So I'm, that means I'm a PhD rather than an MD. It means I don't wear a suit and tie on stage very often. You know, it means that I don't look like a business person. And that helps, because it also helps that facially. It also helps that facially I don't look particularly materialistic. You know, I have a long beard and a long ponytail and so on. So part of it is that. But yes, in terms of evaluation, I mean, it's just a matter of experience, really. You know, I've been in this field a very long time. I know what telltale signs to look for. I know what I need to know in order to be able to evaluate something objectively. And I know how to avoid being suckered, I guess.
Yes. Do you have a large pool of people? How much interest in science, if we were to take the entire field of biomedical science that there is there a talent pool that is investing in this?
There certainly is. It's growing all the time. It's extremely heartening. I mean, even 5 years ago, the rejuvenation biotechnology industry just didn't exist. One could not use that term, because there were just too few, people working in the private sector trying to get this going, and there were no investors to speak of. And over those 5 years, that has completely transformed. We have been able to, I mean, we at Sense Research Foundation, my organization has spun out half a dozen projects into companies. There's now well over 100, probably a couple of hundred relevant companies that have come up from elsewhere that are at every stage from just concept through to clinical trials, and every kind of valuation from, you know, $100,000 to $100 million or more. So yes, it's a real industry now.
God, that's wonderful. So what is on your plate at this time here in the end of March of 2020, when you're looking at, when we're looking at this global pandemic, how do you leverage this time, and how are you looking at what's going on in the world as a scientist? And
yeah, okay. So first of all, how am I using my time? Well, yeah, I've got a lot more time than I normally have, because in normal times, my occupation consists, in terms of actual partitioning of my time, it consists largely of traveling around the world giving talks. And of course, I'm not doing that at all right now, which helps a good deal. So I'm catching up on a whole bunch of things, you know, writing editorials, writing papers, stuff like that. And also, of course, planning what's going to happen next. There's plenty of planning that can still happen in terms of new experiments and, you know, discussions of where we might, what areas we might emphasize in the future. So I'm doing a bunch of that. But how do I look at this in the future? Well, I think actually I'm trying to figure out how to extract some kind of silver lining from the pandemic. And I think there is one.
Yes.
What's definitely going to happen after all of this is that we are all, as a society, as a species, we are going to take health much more seriously. Because at the end of the day, people already take wealth seriously, and failure to take health seriously has very severely impacted our wealth. So, you know, it's going to, that's not going to happen again. The question then is, having decided to take health more seriously, how are we going to do it smartly? How are we going to do it intelligently? And one thing that, again, might end up being a bit of a silver lining here is the fact that the coronavirus is so extremely more dangerous for the elderly than it is for younger people. Of course, a small number of younger people still get sick, but only a very much smaller number. The gradient, so to speak, the dependence on age is considerably more severe than it is for regular flu that happens every year. So that will, I think, cast a much brighter light than before on the importance of maintaining and indeed restoring the effectiveness of the immune system in the elderly. We've known for a long time that the immune system goes downhill in late life, and that this is largely why people get flu and such like at a greater incidence in late life. But now we see what an infection can do to people who get sick when they're old. That very much further emphasizes the importance of this research. And there is plenty of great, very exciting research going on in this space, which could definitely do with a lot more money. So I think, you know, that could be a silver lining. In general, I think just, you know, having policymakers and decision makers around the world realize that there are things that can be done that will improve people's health, both at the level of infectious diseases and at the level of the chronic progressive conditions of late life that I mainly work on, things that can be done that, haven't had enough attention paid to them, and that paying that attention in advance before a crisis happens actually pays off.
Perfect. I'm interested in, all right, so envision for me, Aubrey, in biogerontology, here we have a life different. So our lifespans are larger. Our working time gets to be larger. I mean, we keep this 40, 65-year-old retirement and then move on? Doesn't our entire way of looking at life or way of living life have to change also?
Well, kind of, but not in quite the way that you're describing. So
please help me to describe it better.
Sure. One mistake that people are incredibly prone to make when they think about the future, and in particular when they think about the relatively distant future, like 20 or 30 years out, in which some particular thing is going to be very different, like in this case, we're going to be able to keep people healthy for a lot longer. They tend to evaluate that world and think and envision that world in under the assumption that everything else is more or less the same as it is today. So, which is complete nonsense, of course. So in the case that you just came up with about how long one would work, you know, that's a thing that a lot of people immediately think. And when you talk to people in government, especially about the idea of keeping people healthy and alive for a lot longer, they will basically immediately jump to the thought of, oh God, how are we going to pay the pensions? And at that point, you know, the conversation is over. They will immediately switch their brains off and, you know, they won't be interested. So one has to actually remind such people that actually there are a bunch of other stuff happening at the same time, a bunch of other technologies that are coming along that need to be evaluated in parallel. And in particular, what I'm talking about here, of course, is automation. The fact that, you know, 20 years from now, we're, even by conservative predictions by agencies like the United Nations, most of the jobs that exist today simply won't exist anymore. I'm pretty sure that 20 or 30 years from now, we will not have an economy, a global economy, that is driven by the assumption of essentially full employment. You know, 150 years ago, when the Industrial Revolution happened, we kind of got away with it. We were able to perpetuate the idea of basically full employment. And the way we did it, of course, was by inventing a whole new sector called the service sector to replace all the jobs that were lost in manufacturing and agriculture. I don't think that's going to happen this time. There just isn't another sector out there. You know, how many people do you need in the entertainment industry? So I believe that the economy is going to be built on a different way of distributing wealth that does not require this. So we've already got, of course, very, you know, crude but, you know, promising initial ideas in this space, things like universal basic income. You know, that's a very blunt instrument. It's only a start. But, you know, by the time we actually start needing this, 10, 20, 30 years from now, I believe we're going to have had the time to develop a rather effective and sophisticated way to distribute wealth equitably that does not require people to do stuff that they would not do unless they were being paid for it. And that means that the whole idea of worrying about pensions in the context of demographic change that might happen after that point, you know, is completely misguided.
Yes, I agree with you. And one of the things that I'm interested in, because I have a deep connection to purpose. When I am purposeful, when I feel like I am on purpose, I have meaning. When I feel like I don't have purpose, rather than when I'm just consuming, my sense of meaning, my sense of purpose goes down significantly. So that's the place where I would like to see how we can connect in this time, assuming that we're living to get longer and we have a universal basic income and we're able, the AI has helped us and automation has helped us to solve many of the particular life skill problems. It's how do we evolve as human beings to be more purposeful for one another?
You have really hit the nail on the head there. That's extremely important. And if, in fact, we can just start with the question of how can we remain as purposeful as we are today in a scenario where we're not evaluating our purpose on the basis of the size of our paycheck. which of course most people really today do.
Exactly, and how we value ourselves. Exactly, my value is because I work.
Right, exactly. Now, of course, there are some people already who have the great privilege to derive their self-esteem and their self-worth in other ways. So I'm a perfectly good example of that. You know, I don't work on the defeat of aging because I'm able to be paid for it. I only earn money. I do it because I can. And the fact that I'm making a significant difference to the rate at which we win the war on aging is, you know, extraordinarily fulfilling in its own right. So what we need to do is develop a society in which everyone gets fulfillment in that kind of way. Now, of course, not everyone can be a technological pioneer like me, but everyone can, in one way or another, derive fulfillment from enriching each other's lives or whatever. And that does not necessarily need to be determined by a paycheck. So the question is to develop a system to replace the paycheck.
That's a fascinating world that I want to live. That I want. I would love to be able to both live in and to be able to see what can come out of that. So your work right now, you're doing research. You're collating the magazine, right? And then you're connecting people. Or is it mostly in the West Coast of the United States, or is this a global connection that you're able to do things and connect investors to people who are doing virtually?
Oh, it's definitely a global thing. I mean, the reason why my speaking invitations take up such a high proportion of my time is the travel time. You know, that's a thing. But it is the case that Silicon Valley is the epicenter of this right now. And, you know, that's a large part of why I've ended up living here. And it's an extremely good place to get things done. You know, ultimately, there's a cultural reason why Silicon Valley has not only acquired but maintained its, you know, well-deserved reputation for being the global foundry of pioneering technology. You know, there's just a much healthier attitude to failure in Silicon Valley than there is anywhere else in the world. If you're anywhere else in the world and you try something and you fail, then most people will decide that you're probably not very good. Whereas in Silicon Valley, if you try something and you fail, then the default evaluation of you is that you tried something that was so hard that it couldn't be done, and therefore you have courage, which should give you another chance.
Exactly. And aren't there things that we learn during the trials, that we learn during the efforts, that we would not have learned had we not tried it, even when we did not succeed, that ends up additive? Isn't that part of the scientific process?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just part of the scientific process. It's part of the technological process. I think it's important to distinguish between those two things, because the ways in which scientists use what they already know to decide how to find out what they don't know is actually very different from the way that technologists do it. Especially in the case of technology, you know, having that kind of attitude to failure is absolutely critical.
Right. So how have you kept are you wired as an optimist? Are you wired in the middle? Or how are you rejuvenating and keeping your perspective at this time at the end of March of 2020?
Well, I mean, yes, I would say that I am inherently an optimist, but I want to say two things about that. First of all, I do not like to be called an optimist. Because in general, when people call me an optimist, what they mean is that they think I'm being over-optimistic.
Exactly.
No, I'm not accusing you of that, but I think a lot of people think that way.
Pragmatism and optimism can coexist, can't they?
Oh, yes, they certainly can. You're absolutely right. And the second thing I want to say is I'm kind of, you know, I'm extraordinarily privileged because I'm sitting there at the coalface seeing all the progress that's being made at an early stage before most people could see it, or even if they could see it before they could evaluate it. So I have a much better opportunity to maintain optimism, you know, than most people do who only see the very much more occasional big stories that come out every few years only, you know, that constitute really substantial bits of progress. I see the little bits of progress and they add up.
How lovely. What a wonderful opportunity that you get.
And it's extraordinarily privileged.
And so when you're going ahead and seeing what is coming up, is there anything that you want to that you're particularly working or excited about right now that pings your interest that you'd like to share with that you can share with the general audience who are non-scientists that we can say here are the things that are being tested or tried or thought about in the coming future?
So if I were to try to talk about specific projects, then I would get, you know, I would get out of the non-scientist depth pretty quickly. So let me just summarize the science by saying that the whole approach to keeping people healthy late in life is a damage repair approach, an approach in which we restore the molecular and cellular structure and composition of the body to something like how it was at an earlier age. And because it's a damage repair approach, it is necessarily a divide and conquer approach in which a whole bunch of different damage repair therapies have to be developed and administered at the same time to the same people. So that means that the priority that an organization like my foundation has to have is to focus on the most difficult types of damage, the ones that are hardest to repair, and indeed that other people are neglecting simply because they have, for whatever reason, a need to work on lower hanging fruit. So the thing I say by way of generalizing the scientific situation is simply that the situation is now very different from what it was even 5 years ago, in the sense that we have made progress on all of the really most difficult areas of damage. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have had to hold my hand up and admit that there were two major areas of damage in which, despite a lot of effort, we had failed to make significant progress. But now, in both of those areas, we have made an enormous leap forward and things are moving very well. So that's really what I want to say about the science. But actually, the thing that I want to emphasize even more than that is that the areas of damage repair which are a bit easier, which are kind of, you know, somewhere in the middle between easiest and most difficult, those things are ones which 5 years ago were still the province of academics and foundations like mine. And now they are in the private sector. They are being pushed forward by private companies. And that means that they are being funded much, much better than they would have been in any situation that was purely philanthropic or indeed funded by the government. So, of course, that means that the science is moving faster. And in most cases, those projects are either already in clinical trials or they will be in clinical trials this year. So we're now talking about a really substantial acceleration and about a situation in which these therapies are really pretty close to being applied to being actually, you know, approved for clinical use. Now, the one caveat that I want to also emphasize in closing this answer is that the real jackpot, you know, the real full benefit of these therapies will only be seen when they can be combined, when they can be applied to the same people at the same time. And that will a whole bunch of additional testing after we have got each of the therapies working individually on the probably quite small subpopulations of people for whom the particular therapy is valuable on its own, even in the absence of the other therapies. Nevertheless, every step forward in the clinic is much more conspicuous and much more power in, you know, dispelling people's pessimism and fatalism about aging than a result that's merely in the laboratory.
Perfect. Well, on this last bit, I would just like to ask you something about the difference when the mind-body connection and who I think I am, this Dennis who inhabits this particular body, and my mind. Is there a part of biogerontology that is working on how we relate to not just our brains as a functioning machine, but as the freshness of consciousness, as a being? I don't know how to ask this question, Aubrey. Can you help me ask it in a better way?
No, I get the general idea. The big thing I want to emphasize is there is a difference between between the question of consciousness and the question of cognitive function. So,
right.
For sure, there is absolutely no point in developing therapies that keep the body like that of a 30-year-old, but do not keep the brain like that of a 30-year-old. And that is, of course, not what we're doing. We are definitely in the process of developing therapies that will fix both the brain, the mind, and the body. And that is actually not even particularly difficult, because the brain is made of the same stuff that the rest of the body is. I mean, the cells are a bit different, but they're made of the same things. They're made of, you know, DNA and proteins and such like, and they develop more or less the same kinds of damage. So we can use the same kinds of therapies to address them. So that's good news. And then, of course, the next question is does the health of the body actually impact the health of the brain, and vice versa? And yes, it certainly does. For example, we do know that stress is bad for you in general, not just bad for your brain, but bad for your body in general. When I say stress, what I mean is not necessarily stressful situations, but rather the response, you know, being stressed by a situation. So
yeah.
I can tell you something, a useful thing that reflects that. If you look at centenarians, people who have lived to 100 years old, of course, that's only a small minority of people, now people are very interested in what those people have in common so that we can try to, you know, emulate them for other people. And it turns out that that's a bit of a frustrating task, because they have almost nothing in common. You know, some centenarians smoke a bit, some centenarians are a bit overweight, and so on. But there is one thing that they do have in common, which is nothing bothers them. They haven't necessarily had, you know, particularly stress-free lives, but when they're in a stressful situation, they just let roll with it, much better than the average person. So stress is definitely important. However, let me emphasize one really, really important thing here, which is that this is not really about consciousness in the way you phrased the question originally. You know, whatever consciousness is, you know, whether there is any kind of non-physical component of the human, of what it is to be human, what we do know
exactly.
is that non-thing is somehow trapped within the body while the body is alive. So we don't need to actually be focusing on the mind or the soul or whatever for the purpose of restoring and maintaining mental as well as physical health during life.
Good. Well, I'm interested in that, because as a 71-year-old man about to be 72, my death is much closer to me than it would have been 20 years ago, actuarially speaking. And so it's just something that, and the quality of my mind and the quality of my experience is very important to me. And I agree with you that my stress levels and what I carry really deeply impact me physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Aubrey, is there anything else that you want to, that I have not asked about that would be important to talk about today?
Well, of course, you haven't asked, where do I send the check? That's the most important question of all.
Would you please?
Right. So, of course, we have a website, sense.org, S for sugar, E for elephant, N for November, S for sugar.org. And we've got a huge amount of information there that's written for every kind of audience, from complete novices all the way through to experts in the biology of aging. And, of course, lots of news stuff, not just what we're doing, but what other people are doing. And there's a comment form where you can write questions for anything that you can't find an answer to on the site. And we're very good at answering those. And, of course, there is a nice, big, friendly donate button. And if you want to raise a really big check, then other ways.
This is at the scns.org.
That's right.
All right. Well, that'll be right there on the front page, and please go to Aubrey's website and read over, learn, comment, and donate. Aubrey, thank you for giving me the second opportunity to be able to talk with you today. Thank you for the research that you're doing and for one of the things that I admire about you is that you're like you're like one of these masons who were building a cathedral, that you know that you may not see the completed cathedral, but you know that the bricks that you're putting in place are going to be there and contribute to the health and well-being of many beyond you.
Well, thank you very much. And, of course, thank you for having me on the show, Dennis. I'm very grateful always to be able to educate a new audience.
All right. Thank you, Aubrey, and we'll talk to you another time.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Dennis Chardon, and we'll see you next time.